task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to another episode of The Elephant in the Room. This is a week where we've had a lot of consequential politics happening in the country. And the elephant in the room is the preview of November. I want to start with California because it is the oddest, potentially the most consequential in some ways, primary election we had this week. In Los Angeles, as of this recording, we have Spencer Pratt in second place, which he has no business being in second place.
Who is your political role model?
Jesus Christ.
Okay, I mean, that's what
he was a politician. He had to go in and
are there any modern politicians that you're especially studying or drawn to?
No.
And Karen Bass for the mayor of LA.
Well, I think for the undecided voters to understand that they have a choice to make. And that choice is a reality TV villain? Really? How did that work for us on a national level?
He's a lot closer to her than anyone anticipated, except for me. Because while I said over and over again, it's not an endorsement of Spencer Pratt, but the campaign he was running, not just the crazy AI viral video ads.
Spencer Pratt says no one in their right mind would vote for Karen Bass. Well, Spencer's wrong.
I'm voting for Karen Bass because I want to keep injecting in public parks.
I'm voting for Karen Bass because I like it here.
I'm voting for Karen Bass because I'll be damned if I go back to jail.
I'm voting for Karen Bass because I have a Polymarket bet that the Palisades won't be rebuilt before 2030.
I'm voting for Karen Bass because the more homeless people there are, the more money my nonprofit can raise to fight homelessness.
I'm voting for Karen Bass because my parents support Spencer Pratt and I have unresolved daddy issues.
Vote Karen Bass. She works for us.
Not just the sort of reality TV star thing, but the campaign that framed the critique of the city as being unable to handle its toughest problems and most visible problems is a campaign I've seen before and that I've run before. That campaign was greeted with derision by a lot of people in the Democratic establishment. It was greeted with derision by a lot of people who said, oh, you're just a reality TV star. And my response was, have you not paid attention for the last decade? A reality television star who should not win a race, wins a race. Pay attention. Because for my Democratic friends, I will tell you, beg you, warn you, counsel you, whatever word you want to choose. If you ignore quality of life issues in your campaigns, if you pretend that they're just the complaints of rich white suburbanites, you will lose. If you pretend that homeless encampments in your city are okay, or that they don't exist, and people see them every day, you're going to lose. This is a long pattern. It's happened many times before. I don't like political monocultures, left or right, frankly. I don't think they do well in the end. I think they need to have disruption and change sometimes. I'm not arguing, once again, for Spencer Pratt. I have no brief for Spencer Pratt. He seems like a basic bitch reality TV guy. But what I am arguing is that if you don't believe that campaigns can be changed by people who find something that pokes that quality of life button among regular voters, you're going to get surprised and you're going to get caught up. Now, look, Bass will still probably win. I will tell you, she is not a good candidate. I can't qualitatively assess her job as mayor because I don't live in LA. But I think you are in a state in California where you got more Republicans than any other state in the country. And while they all live out in those suburbs and they all live out in those low population counties around the Nevada border side of the state, you need to be aware that you can lose. So in the governor's race, as of this recording, looks like we're going to have Becerra and Steve Hilton. Okay, you got the Trump guy in Steve Hilton, and you've got Javier Becerra, who, as many people have said over and over again, he's kind of boring. He's kind of boring. That's okay. Becerra, as my friend Mike Madrid says, scans more as East LA than East Bay, and I think that helps. I think he comes across in a way where he can get some more working class voters in the door. And he can address something that California is in a raging, screaming, insane crisis about, which is housing.
most housing that's built today is reserved for single family homes. Very little construction is done with apartments and condominiums. Very little to buy other than single family homes. We're never going to reach the number we need if we continue to only build single family homes. And that's why the legislation that allows us to really build out, do the infill, where we know we have transportation, will give us an opportunity to increase greater amounts of housing at affordable rates for people who need to either buy or rent. And I think that if we do that and come up with a stable source of funding into the future, so it's not just a one-time housing bond that people can count on, developers will begin to have confidence that we are looking to give them a predictable means of being able to finance these projects and have them pencil out.
I think he's got a pretty solid message on that. Hilton is going to try to do, he's going to try to do a shift in the coming weeks, where he suddenly becomes the more reasonable version of Trumpism, where he suddenly becomes the California guy who wants to make California great again.
Except this is the kind of thing I think you get with 16 years of one-party rule, this corrupt Democrat machine in power for so long. They just lose touch with reality. They don't realize how ridiculous this all seems to normal people. And there's no pressure on them. There's no sense of accountability to change. But that's actually why I think we're going to get a good result this year, not just in this primary, but in the general election, because we're done with all this. I think it's got to a point where people are really sick of it.
He'll do a little bit of shimmy to shift to the center a bit on some issue or another. He'll find a way to break away from Trump on some issue, and everybody will go, oh, that was amazing. I can't believe it. Just, it's an act, but it's not an incompetent act. He's surrounded by people who are not stupid. He has a lot of detriments against him, but he's not a stupid person. So pay attention to that. I want to switch from California to Iowa now, because Iowa is the big deal. Iowa's results this week are setting that state up for potentially an almost complete flip. We now have three Democratic congressional candidates in Iowa who can win. We now have a governor's candidate in Rob Sand who can win.
Call me old-fashioned. I'd say stealing's bad. That's why I locked up corrupt public officials as a prosecutor. And as state auditor, I uncovered record amounts of misspent tax dollars. Insiders didn't like that, so they changed the law to make it harder for me to find your misspent tax money. That's bad, too. As governor, I'll make jail time mandatory for public officials who misuse your tax dollars. Because stealing is still bad, and stealing from taxpayers should be unacceptable.
So I want you to watch a couple of these clips from Rob Sand, who is an incredibly inspirational guy. There's a category of candidate rising in the Democratic Party right now who I think is doing the rhetoric the right way. And that includes Rob Sand here and there in Iowa. It includes Tallarico in Texas. It includes David Jolly in Florida. And as much as the MAGAs are holding their pearls and rolling their eyes and having a hissy fit, it includes Graham Plattner in Maine. Watch that clip from Santa.
To the majority of GOP primary voters who voted for someone other than Zach Lane, I agree with you. His lies about his past and the fact that he still more or less lives in Kansas means that he's not the best choice in this race. He claims to be an outsider, but he has spent his whole career working for politicians and dark money groups. He claims he's going to take on big polluters, but he did the political bidding of nitrate polluters who are squeezing every penny out of Iowa farmers for a decade. He says he's going to be Iowa first, but records show he spends more time in Kansas than he does here. And he admits he'd have to fully move here from Kansas if he gets elected. The phrase was, if I get elected, I'll spend as much time as humanly possible in Iowa. Most of us just live here. He says he's focused on kids and culture, but he's invested in products that I wouldn't want to talk about in front of my kids. And then he lied about at what point he got uninvested, too. If he's going to say all of those things, who knows what he's going to say or what you can believe when it comes to this campaign for the next 5 months. Traveling the state for the last year of this campaign, I've heard the same stuff everywhere I go. The political system is broken. It has left Iowa families behind. Well, all you would get with Zach Lane is more of the same. He's been on the inside breaking it this whole time. I'm going to tell you the truth about him, just as I did with every corrupt public official that I prosecuted or audited. But I also want to talk about how I'll work with the Republican legislature in this state to get a new direction going and a focus on making Iowa not bluer or redder, but truer and better. I believe we should have a governor that actually puts Iowa first instead of just writing it under the wings of his plane when he flies over us to go back to Kansas. We already have more Iowa Republican donors than the Republican nominee for governor does. Join them. You're welcome in this campaign.
And then I want to play a clip from Turek, who is up for the U.S. Senate seat.
I was born an underdog. 21 surgeries by the age of 12. Spina bifida, caused by my dad's exposure to Agent Orange in Vietnam. A kid wearing Goodwill hand-me-downs with the wrong color lunch ticket. But I never doubted my right to the American dream. Sitting in my wheelchair, 9 years old, watching the Olympics, I dreamed of winning gold for my country, too.
Guess who on the left side? Josh Turek.
Back-to-back gold medals.
I campaigned just like I played basketball, outworking everyone, pushing the hills, crawling the stairs, all just to have a conversation with everyday Iowans. Did not matter the party, because it's working-class families like mine paying the price for Ashley Hinson's corruption in Washington. Hinson helps herself and her donors, while Iowans get screwed in every deal. Hospitals closing, gas and grocery prices through the roof, and the farm economy hammered. Iowans deserve a senator who works for them again. So if you are ready to push for change, join me.
He's a guy who, once again, is falling in this new category of Democratic candidates who are more comfortable talking about the economy, more comfortable talking about working class people, and not trying to do it from the policy book perspective, but trying to do it from the gut and the heart. So I think Iowa is going to be a state to really pay attention to. At Lincoln Project, we're going to be invested in Iowa this year. We're going to be doing a lot of work there because we play Moneyball. It's inexpensive to campaign in Iowa. Texas, California, a little more expensive by a factor of 100. So I want you to pay attention to that. I want you to watch that very carefully because Iowa is a state that went with Trump, had been in the minds of a lot of Republicans trending red. They thought they were going to get another locked up state. It's going to be done. This is a state that is shifting under the Republicans' feet right now. They need to watch this, and we need to watch this, because if these candidates do their job correctly, and in Iowa, even in metro areas of Iowa, they are all deeply affected by what's happened in the farm economy. And the farm economy has been smacked in the face by the Trump administration, first by tariffs, very, very, very damaging tariffs to the Iowa farm economy. And I mean every part of it. I mean hogs, corn, every part of the economy has taken a hit because of tariffs. And secondly, because of the Iran war, which is on again, off again, on again, off again, who knows? It's the Schrodinger's war. They're paying $7 a gallon for diesel fuel to put in their agricultural equipment, in their tractors, and in their combines. And they're paying enormously higher premiums for fertilizer.
And when you talk to people in this state, at the gas pump or out on their farms, yes, Iran is very much on their minds because the cost of things has gone up since late February when the war began. Take, for example, Aaron Lehman, who's a farmer up in Polk City, about 20, 30 minutes outside of Des Moines. We talked about the fact that prices have spiked for things like fertilizer and diesel, and that's rubbing off on all sorts of other parts of the Iowa economy, including manufacturing companies like this one. Listen to what Aaron had to tell us.
So when this White House says it's the best friend a farmer has ever had, you say...
That doesn't say much about my friends, because people are out here hurting. You know, the rhetoric about a golden age of agriculture right around the corner, that doesn't match the reality of what's going on the ground at all.
So Iowa is a state where if these candidates from the congressional races up to the Senate and governor's race, if these folks stick to their knitting and connect the economy, the corruption in Washington, and the damage that's been done to Iowa farms and families, that state is going to be one of the most significant political flips of the cycle. You flip Texas for Florida, that's a big deal too. And in both of those states, we are seeing real movement. They're both the highest possible hill to climb, okay? But Iowa is a state that will reshape a lot of the political dialogue going forward. If we have a Democratic sweep in the state of Iowa, it changes the Republican and Democratic primaries in 2028. It's a major, major, major implication to the tone and the messaging of candidates from both parties who are going to go there to try to do this, you know, early game work. Now, in Iowa also, Donald Trump's magic is broken. Back to a guy named Randy Feenstra. And Feenstra, I'm going to go to the Wayback Machine here. Any of you guys, you remember Steve King? Yes, that's Steve King. The Steve King who Stephen Miller thinks is too racist about immigration. Feenstra beat Steve King in a primary a few years ago. 20, I believe. And you know what? The power of Trump is amazing. Trump endorsed Feenstra this time. But the power of petty revenge grudge matches among old white Republican bros is also pretty fucking amazing. Steve King built a new candidate, basically, this guy Zach Lahn, to go after Feenstra, and he beat him. Trump's endorsement did not matter. His complete and total endorsement, as you may recall, it did not matter. Did not matter. The fact is, the Washington Press Corps puts way too much emphasis on Trump's ability to win MAGA primaries. It largely is the case he wins MAGA primaries. It largely is the case that he can tell the primary voters, I don't like this guy. He's bad. He's corrupt. He's wrong. But it doesn't matter at the end of the day, because a lot of the people Trump picks in these primaries are great for the Democrats. A lot of the people he picks in these primaries have been Ken Paxtons, have been Byron Donalds types. These people who are really corrupt and fucked up and not really good at what they need to accomplish in a year where Donald Trump's negatives are cataclysmically bad for the GOP. He still was net positive on the economy in 2018 at this time. And Democrats won 40 seats, 41 when you count the final run out. Guys, 40 seats. Now, are we going to have the same result this year? Well, redistricting, no, and some other changes in the way the maps look, just from pure demographic alteration. We're not going to get to that just based on the clean analysis or the clean, you know, extrapolation. But the numbers are so bad. The numbers are so horrific. The numbers are so insanely over the top. And Andrew and I will be talking about this on Behind the Numbers on Friday, as we always do, where we go through the polling. And this week, we've seen the electoral shifts matching up to the danger that the GOP faces. Those electoral shifts, we saw it in Texas 2 weeks ago now. Was it a week ago? And time flies when you're in hell. Where only 900,000 Republicans came out to vote in a primary? That's not great. These results you're seeing, they're good and bad, but they're bad almost across the board for the GOP. If their big hook is that they managed to get a Republican through a jungle primary in the state of California for the governor's race, honestly, I guess that's not that big a hook. As we watch in the next few weeks, we're going to see some more primaries wrapping up soon. Then there'll be a sort of burst of them in the late part of the summer, or, you know, August-ish area. But all of this election is shaping up, continues to shape up. And even these little, this small number of races this week are continuing to show us all those indications that the Republicans are going to get their gut stomped out if the Democrats just stay on message. I know that is a high assignment. That is a tall mountain to climb for our Democratic friends. But please, for the love of God, remember the two rules of the Republican Party. Just win is rule number one, and stay on message is rule number two. If you are confused by rule number one, please consult rule number two. If rule number two presents any challenges to your understanding, please consult rule number one. Those election results are an elephant in the room for one more reason. There is a belief inside some circles in the Democratic Party that we're already so far ahead that you can switch back and start being lazy. Or you can switch back and start doing what you want to do rather than what you must do. I beg of you, do not take that bait. The other elephant in the room this week is the end stage, the sort of final boss stage of most autocratic systems. In most autocratic systems, let's say you've got a hypothetical revolution somewhere, and you start out with a few members of the revolutionary cadre who agree to share power, who agree to, you know, try to establish whatever their ideology is in the country. You know, Fidel and Che and the other people that were around Fidel in the beginning, okay? And this iterates in Russia, all over the place. But it always resolves like this. The coalition that wins the revolution shrinks down to one person as the primary guy, as the dictator, as the capo di tutti capi, as the main dude. Okay? And obviously, in Trump's universe, Trump is the main dude. And many of the people who would have been either fellow travelers with him or rivals inside their own movement, they've all bent the knee to Trump. They've all bowed down to Trump. And it's understandable. It's explicable. You get it. I get it. We all see it. But the elephant in the room is that no authoritarian system elevates competence. No authoritarian system elevates skill. In the end, and it's particularly true with Donald Trump, they elevate not just loyalty, because people can be loyal to you and tell you you're screwing up. People can be loyal to you and tell you, hey, you got to make a change. People can be loyal to you and tell you, hey, I'd rather you do it this way because we'll get better results. In fact, I would argue that that is one of the definitions of loyalty, is telling your friends and your loved ones and your colleagues when something's going wrong and something's going off the tracks, that something's going wrong and there's a way to fix it. But with Trump, as you've seen for the last year and a half now, they're not allowed to do that anymore. And so the circle of loyalists, the circle of the pure, the circle of those who are around Trump that he trusts and relies on and believes in and gives bigger and bigger assignments, regardless of their competence, was put on very, very full display this week. The moment I saw him name Bill Pulte as the acting director of national intelligence and sending his nomination to the Senate for DNI, I knew two things were going to happen. One, there are even Trump Republicans in the Senate who were immediately looking for the exits. Like, no, not this guy. He has no foreign policy experience. He has no diplomatic experience. He has no intelligence experience. He has no defense experience. He was a home builder in Florida. I am not a fan of Tulsi Gabbard for many reasons. But Tulsi Gabbard, at least at the barest minimum, was an intelligence officer in the U.S. military. That's not a huge qualification to be DNI, but it's better than nothing. The other thing I understood immediately about this, and I think you should really pay attention to, is that Bill Pulte represents this moment, this closing act in the authoritarian circus. Trump doesn't trust almost anyone around him anymore, and he shouldn't. A lot of them are eyeing the exits. A lot of them are eyeing the 2028 map. A lot of them are eyeing how they're going to get out of there without going to prison, all these things. But Pulte has been one of his little hatchet men. He's the guy that's gone after Comey and Letitia James and all these other folks and Linda Cook, all these people for whether or not they had, you know, mortgage fraud, which was a bullshit lie in every case, right? But Trump liked it. Because here was a guy at Freddie Mae or Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Here was a guy in the housing department, not exactly the front lines of American political warfare as a general rule, who was using his power to persecute Trump's enemies in a way that Trump viewed was more effective than Tulsi Gabbard had been doing, even though she showed up for the Georgia records seizure in that illegal raid. Trump loved that. He loved that this guy in a position of nothingness was finding a way to screw over Trump's enemies. Now, it was paper thin. It was always BS. It never held up. But Trump loved that because Pulte is the kind of stooge and toady that survives now in this end stage. To go back to what I was talking about, like how revolutions take things over, okay? You know, Robespierre fell to the guillotine as well. The cadres that establish a revolution always collapse on themselves, always eat themselves. These people are fighting internally over who's going to be the one. I mean, the Highlander theory of there can be only one is real inside Trump's cabinet. I mean, you see these leaks about J.D. Vance and Trump hating J.D. Vance. That comes from Mike Needham, who is Marco's main guy. Okay? Don't fool yourself where that's coming from. And Trump doesn't help. He throws a lot of chum in the water, too. He tries to screw with people, too. Because when you see him say, "I Marco's doing a great job."
I'm telling you, he's going to go down as the best Secretary of State in the country's history.
I became a diplomat for the first time. Well, you know who taught me that? Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio.
Marco's doing a fantastic job in many ways, too. So I want to just thank you all for a great job. Marco, you're doing a great job.
It's not just because he's picked Marco, because he'll turn on Marco, too. In the end of the day, he'll turn on Marco, too. It's because Trump loves to cause chaos in his own organization. And that chaos leads to everyone in the organization trying to do greater and greater and greater demonstrations of loyalty to Trump. So when you see a guy like Pulte, who is an incompetent, who is a boob, who has no experience at all, he's the son, he's the nepo baby of a major developer. Not even great houses, by the way. Not so great. When you see that kind of person rising, you know you're nearing the end. You know you're nearing the terminus of the authoritarian game. Because no one can really establish a rival power center to the dictator. Think about North Korea. The Kim family has ruled North Korea now for 80 plus years. Name another senior North Korean official. Anyone? Anyone? You know, we only got to know Saddam's people when we started, knocking the crap out of them. And, we ended up doing the deck of cards so Americans could learn who Chemical Ali was. And you did see Baghdad Bob. All these people were at the end of Saddam's long run. Saddam was in power, I think, about 35 years at that point. And he had winnowed away everybody competent and kept everybody who was a loyalist. And it makes the organizations weaker and weaker over time. It makes them have poor and poorer and poorer judgment over time. Trump doesn't get good advice from anybody at this point. But when Bessent and Hassan and Peter Navarro leave him stuck on stupid on the tariffs, you know what a loyal advisor would do? You know what a good advisor would do? They'd say, boss, this is stupid. We got to stop this. We got to cut this out. It's moronic. But they won't and they can't, because they know that truth is something that Trump cannot abide. Even constructive criticism in his mind is disloyalty. Boss, don't touch that hot stove. Is interpreted as, I hate you. And then he touches the hot stove, burns himself, hurts himself, and looks at the same advisor who goes, why didn't you tell me not to touch the hot stove? I don't understand. Why are you so disloyal? It is, unfortunately, for Trump's world, a restraining factor that has very little give left. No one better is coming into this administration. No one smarter is coming into this administration. No one more competent or capable is coming into this administration. They will not survive. There's a reason Susie Wiles is sort of in the corner now. And that is because Susie Wiles, whether you like her or not, is a capable and competent person. And there were a lot of people who were tricked by Susie Wiles in the course of the campaign, particularly on the fundraising side. I talked to a guy on Wall Street who did not want to be with Trump again. Big, big name. Big, big name. Did not want to be with Trump again. He's not a Democrat. He's not a progressive. None of that, right? But said to me at a thing in New York, right after the election, well, Susie's going to be so good. She's very smart. She's very capable. She knows what she's doing. And here's the famous line. She'll keep him from doing anything really destructive. Trump wants to do the destructive things. Trump wants to do the bad things. He wants to cause the chaos. He wants to cause the suffering. He wants to cause the fear and the anxiety and the economic damage. Because the more chaos he has, the less we look at things like his character, like his relationship to Jeffrey Epstein, like his insane level of grift and thievery in Washington. But to execute those things, you have to have executioners. And the ones who are competent and evil, even they are slowly going to be pushed out by the ones who are competent or incompetent and evil and up Trump's ass. Why is Stephen Miller still there? In any other administration, Stephen Miller would have been booted out of there. He would never have been in the door, first off. But Stephen Miller has a particular style. I've been told this by multiple people around the president over the last 8 years, really now, that Stephen Miller has a particular way of sucking up to Trump. And Trump loves it. He loves it. Why do you think every cabinet member spends every cabinet meeting going, first off, Mr. President, you're the tallest, handsomest person in the room. You don't smell like Depends. You smell like a summer breeze over a field of lilacs. All the crap of the ass kissing. No one's coming in this administration that's better at what they're doing now. So you're going to see people raised higher and higher and higher in positions that they can't accomplish and that put America in danger. Bill Pulte, put it in charge of our intelligence agencies, puts America in grave danger. I don't think the Senate, and I know at this point that Thune already has reservations, McConnell has stated his reservations publicly, you're not going to see Cornyn or Tillis vote for this guy at this point. And so it'll be even more dangerous because Trump can't get his guy confirmed this time. So he'll make him a temporary acting, blah, 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 provisional, whatever. That is as much danger to the country as I can imagine. An incompetent young guy, he's under 40, 39 years old, who is totally dedicated to Donald Trump, who is a hustler, by the way, who likes making money, in a position in charge of American intelligence, who has proven that he is willing to go out and use America's intelligence tools and America's services to attack Trump's enemies. Bill Pulte is, in the end, going to be somebody who's sort of vaguely remembered in history. But the type of man that Bill Pulte is, the type of men and women that Donald Trump has surrounded himself with, are characters we've seen many times before in history with many authoritarians, and none of them survive in the end. None of them make it. They always end up burning everything down. The ones that do sort of survive it are going to be the ones who get scapegoated. And I got to tell you, we've got 5 months until the election, 2 years and change until Trump's out of office. But the damage guys like Bill Pulte can do in the meantime is incalculable. And that, my friends, is the elephant in the room. Hey, everybody, thank you so much for watching. As always, do me a big favor, go and click like and subscribe on YouTube, or click like, subscribe, follow, whatever it is on the app you're watching or listening to us on. I really appreciate it. It does a great amount of good with the algorithm. You can catch me every week on the Lincoln Project podcast. You can catch me on the strategy session on Lincoln Square, the breakdown on Fridays with Andrew Wilson doing Behind the Numbers, and on the weekends with my beautiful wife, Renee, on a little weekend R&R. We look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
The Lincoln Project podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.